fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB
106.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and we've got the biggest mystery of all. David North Martino in the house.
That's right. A conundrum wrapped in a mystery, wrapped in an enigma. Yeah, or something like that.
You got to, I told you, you can't swear on the air. What are you doing? Conundrum. You're not allowed to say that word.
No.
Filthy boy.
Terrible.
Yeah. Tell you, your mother. I'm going to have to talk to your mother. Yeah. She's got to be better manners than this. So
she'll wash my mouth out with soap.
Did she ever really do that?
No.
No. No. That was a threat.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Was that a normal thing?
It was normal.
Like in your household?
But I don't know anybody that ever really had it done.
Yeah.
But there probably is. But just saying, it never happened to me either. It was threatened. But we did get the belt back.
Yes.
In the old
house. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Warms my heart.
Yes.
Now, today.
The other parts.
Well, I told you, don't talk that way, right? We're an important show here.
That's right.
Okay. So now we have an author joining us, and he's got quite a history. He's been, you know, more than just an author, and it's very interesting. And now the book is called Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. So let's welcome McCracken Poston Jr. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This is the perfectly named podcast for this story.
Yeah, sounds like it. Quite a story. Now, before we get into it, let's talk about you. And before you got into writing this book, it looks like you've been you're part of the Georgia House of Reps. You've had quite a little history of here. So did you know you were going to be getting into writing anywhere in your life? Is this something that kind of just came up late?
You know, I had an elementary school principal that made us all learn and recite Robert Frost poetry. So for a little Southern Appalachian elementary school, we were probably getting ahead of the game, but I had no plans. This story, though, like Maya Angelou said, bearing an untold story inside of you, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of you. And I felt that when I read that quote. I said, I know how that feels, because this case just weighed heavily on me for many, many years. And it was quite a wild ride, as the Atlanta Journal-Constitution said. But it's a true story. It's the classic rush to judgment case. My client was unusual. He probably caused a lot of the suspicion that surrounded him. Well, he definitely caused it. But we finally got a reason just a couple of years ago as to what was motivating him and why he appeared to be so suspicious.
Yes, it's always interesting because you never know until you meet them, kind of. There's always something about being involved in the case rather than just seeing it on TV or hearing about it in a newspaper. What actually drew you into this case where you wanted to write about it?
Well, I grew up in around Ringgold, Georgia. I grew up in a little smaller town, actually, in Catoosa County, Georgia. That's northwest Georgia, just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And this guy was our TV repairman. He was a classic picture tube television sales and repairman under the Zenith brand, hence the name of the book. He went to high school with one of my sisters. And yet the first time I ever really saw him, he was waved into the house by my mother. who didn't tell me, and I was trying to watch live wrestling on television. I was about 13, and suddenly there's a strange man in the house to bring a new knob for our television. I had worn off the channel changer knob, and my father ordered a replacement. The only reason I remembered that years later was the my client, who was very unusual acting, he told me that he had met Andre the Giant. And he told me that Andre the Giant ate a dozen eggs for breakfast and a loaf of bread. And, of course, I went to school telling everybody that I knew somebody who knew Andre the Giant. So I remembered that suddenly when I'm representing this guy for murder, and he tells me the same story. And I thought, you've told me this before. You told me this, you know, decades ago, because I went to school bragging about it. And he was a guy who was extremely difficult, yet he stalked me on the street 3 days after his wife of 32 years was found dead in his house. The problem is nobody knew he had a wife, because he had been denying her existence for almost 30 years. Anybody who asked, hey, weren't you married once? He would come up with a different story to tell them every time. And so he seemed very suspicious. Her siblings kind of revived a lot of old stories about captivity and keeping her family away, and that just fueled everything. The National Examiner tabloid comes out with a headline, Sicko Holds Wife Captive 30 Years, Then Kills Her. And that was, of course, just making it a complete circus. I had just lost a congressional race. And I mean, when I say lost, I got the hell beat out of it. I was pretty down myself. I tried for a presidential appointment. That kind of blew up on my face, even though I wasn't even asking for it. It got suggested that I could be appointed to something, and then it blew up. So I was pretty down. And here's this guy kind of meeting me on the same corner of street for 3 days in a row. And he's a hermit. People hardly ever saw him. And here I'm seeing him 3 days in a row. So when I finally just, you know, looked at him and spoke to him, it just opened up a whole box of ills that he just poured out right there on the street about all the woes that he and his family had endured over the years. And a lot of it was nonsense. There was a lot of civil litigation that he did, and it was the classic definition of frivolous, but he was very sincere about it. He had a kind of a Rube Goldberg causal connection diagram in his head of what made a minor car accident that his father drove away from, how that turned into his father's death 2 years later from pancreatic cancer. So that started all the litigation. He and his wife had been evicted from public housing on September 15, 1970, one of those dates that lived in infamy in his head. And that was the last place and time and date that Virginia Ridley was ever seen. September 15, 1970, in the large courtroom of the Catoosa County Courthouse. So it wasn't an immediate arrest. They continued to talk with him, going against my street advice for him to shut up. He would speak to anybody who would talk to him. He would let them all into his house, into his business, which had been shuttered for 15 years. And yet, when I started to represent him, he would turn me away. He would not let me see his house. And that went on for over a year. So he was an extremely difficult client.
Right. Well, so what did you put together with about the relationship between him and his wife? Was she really captive? Was she secret? Or was it just, like, that seems to be unusual how nobody really knew she existed. Or was that not real?
No, nobody really knew. He wanted me to study all of this old litigation. And to get him to help me with the murder case, I would almost have to strike these bargains. I realized he was very transactional. So I would strike these bargains that I would go look at this old civil litigation, including the eviction, and I would advise him on that, even though it was all dead and done and, you know, res judicata. We were not going to be able to relitigate any of that. But he had me look at it. And I'm really glad he did, because in the eviction file, I found a jury list. It was a jury trial over an eviction. And there were a lot of names that I remembered from childhood, most of them dead, because this had been 27 years later. But I saw a name of a woman that I still knew. So I reached out to the woman. I said, can you tell me about this eviction trial you may or may not remember from 27 years before? And she said, I remember it just like it was yesterday. It was the strangest thing. And she said that my client Alvin had made such a circus out of this trial that the judge just stopped him and said, Mr. Ridley, just get your wife. So his father went and fetched Virginia. She came into the courtroom, and lo and behold, her parents were there, her parents who had been trying to flush her out for 2 or 3 years. They had posted articles in the newspaper that their daughter was missing. They all went back into the judge's chamber, except for Alvin. He was not allowed to go. They all came out, and according to what Alvin reports, his wife and father told him, Virginia cited some scripture and said, I'm with my husband now. I am one with my husband now. That's where I need to be. That's where I want to be. And so her parents pretty much gave up all of the efforts to flush her out. But 27 years later, when she's dead, her sisters and picked up the mantle of the wildest allegations of human captivity, and they ran with it. And, of course, the tabloids and the media ran with it. So it was a very awkward situation. Alvin said from day one that his wife had epilepsy, and that was well known. She had it since childhood, so her family even knew that. She occasionally had reactions to the medicine, so she was really not that compliant with medication. And so what I needed, because the state was saying these little petechial hemorrhages around her eyes and mouth, that was indicative of an asphyxiation death, and they charged Alvin with that murder, I knew that I needed to see another epilepsy death. And fortunately, they're rare. Fortunately, you know, there's good medication available. And so people who have epilepsy are very often, well in control. But out of the blue, just a few months before trial, and I had nothing because Alvin still wouldn't let me in his house, the Olympic track star Florence Griffith Joyner passed away. About a month later, they announced that she died of a seizure disorder. The following Monday, I was on the phone with the doctor in Orange County, California, who autopsied FloJo, as she was popularly called. Her autopsy looked remarkably like that of Virginia Ridley. And this was possibly the most famous athlete in the world at that time. Definitely the most famous one to pass away that year. And because of unfounded allegations of performance-enhancing drugs, she was given an extremely extensive and thorough autopsy. By the way, the only thing in her system was Benadryl and a therapeutic amount. So her greatness really was not tarnished by her death. And so as it turned out, their autopsy, the condition of their bodies were very similar. And so I had that, even though it was going to be very difficult to get in, but I shared it with the DA so he could show it to his state doctor. And then I had an epilepsy expert named Braxton Bryant Wanamaker out of Orangeburg, South Carolina. And this is the guy that in 1998 internet, I was able to find in all the medical abstracts that he seemed to be the expert. And this is 1998. I couldn't cut and paste a URL. So I was handwriting URLs down and very, intensely hoping that I put a forward slash and not a backward slash. It was so tedious. So that's all we had. Thanksgiving of 1998, my new wife, I had gone through a divorce right after the congressional defeat, and I had remarried the next year. We went to Thanksgiving at our different families. And my family, my parents packaged up a sack, and they said, we want you to take this Thanksgiving meal to Mr. Ridley. That was the last place I wanted to go on Thanksgiving, because he and I would fight. We would yell at each other at one point because he wanted to talk about his van being seized by the county. And he wanted to talk about the eviction in 1970. And this was 1998, and we were screaming toward a January 1999 trial date. And here we are, Thanksgiving, 5 weeks out. But I did dutifully deliver this Thanksgiving meal to him. Now, again, I should have realized how transactional he was. When I show up with this delicious meal, he feels like he needs to give me something. So he invited me into his home. And it was the most strange, uncomfortable place, because it was just a poor home with not good ventilation, not a real good smell, and apparently a lot of vermin. But I went in, and when my eyes adjusted to the single light bulb light, I could see one whole wall was covered with writing, and not on the wall, but on pieces of paper that were attached to the wall various ways, nailed, taped, tacked, just a wall covered in writings, and apparently by the same hand. And so immediately, you know, I started reading it, and there's a recipe. Here's a list of the cast of the CBS series The Waltons, with all the actors' names. Here's correspondence with television evangelical ministers, and here's something from the HUD secretary from the 1970s, referencing a letter that she wrote to President Richard M. Nixon about their eviction. And so I said, Alvin, who wrote this? And my heart was beating because I wanted it to be her so badly. And he said, well, Virginia did. And I said, what do you think? Why do you think she wrote so much? And he said, well, because I guess the Lord told her to. Well, it was not just writing a few things down. This woman documented almost every moment of her life. There were boxes and boxes and boxes of notebooks and loose leaf paper. There was the inside of cereal boxes that suddenly had ink written on, turned around, turned into a nice piece of cardboard, and filled with various observations that she had. They weren't ramblings. They all had intent. There would be a Bible lesson. There would be a glossary of legal terms, which I started realizing she may have been the mastermind behind some of that litigation that Alvin was doing, and because she seemed to understand it better than he could articulate it. And so I said, you know, Alvin, I've got to have this. And he said, no, that's all I got left over. You can't have any of it. So I had to start trying to, Alvin and I had this process of communication that happened very early in the case, when he would start yelling at me about his van being taken in 1984. And at one point I was exasperated, and I just said, oh Lord. He stopped. He thought I was praying. And I thought, I can run with this. And so I began to pray my legal advice to him. But he wasn't that naive. I'd get through with this long, you know, fire and brimstone prayer about how he needed to let me in his house, or how he needed to cooperate in the murder case. And he would say, I'll think about it. But the bottom line is he got quiet, and I was able to get out what needed to be done. Interestingly enough, at probably the lowest point of the representation, when I just thought, have I taken on something that I just don't need to be a part of? Our congressman called Now, this was the guy that whipped my butt less than 2 years before. And Alvin got kind of interested that I had the congressman calling me. He seemed to sit up a little straighter, and he chided me for not immediately calling him back. So I called the congressman back, and I said, hello, congressman, how are you doing? He said, keep Alvin Ridley away from my congressional offices. He's scaring the ladies there. Well, in a way, that motivated me. In a way, it was like the election again, only this time I had one constituent, one issue, and that was vindicating Alvin Ridley. And so the congressman really did motivate me and probably kept me in the case. But when I found our epilepsy expert, before I put him on the stand, he just asked this one last question that was absolutely stunning in its impact. He said, was there anything else unusual about this woman? And I laughed and I said, yeah, she could not have a thought without writing it down. And he said, oh, that's hypergraphia. That's often associated with temporal lobe epilepsy. And it's quite common. A lot of my patients have it. That was huge to me because it was not the ramblings of a crazy woman who just, you know, felt the need to write down the cast of the Waltons or send a proposed script, a pitch to the TV show Unsolved Mysteries. And guess what she was pitching to Unsolved Mysteries? The mystery of Alvin's van being taken by Catoosa County authorities.
Oh, yeah. That's what's important here.
And
yeah.
So she shared these paranoid views with him and conspiracy theories with him. They were the perfect couple. It explained to me the last component. And so we had quite a trial. Over several court appearances, Alvin proved to be unreliable to come to court or stay in court. That created quite a problem for me. And at some one point, he fled, and I found him at the VA clinic. He had been a U.S. Army veteran for 2 years. And, you know, I went, the judge said, if you get him back by 1:30, I'll still let you have your motions hearing. And so I just went to Chattanooga and got him because I called up there thinking that was the only place he would go because he was very often complaining about how he felt. He used to cite a non-existing clause of the Constitution saying, the Constitution says you don't have to go to court if you don't feel well. Well, I had to start carrying around paperback copy of the U.S. Constitution to challenge him on it every time he tried to raise it. But I told him he had to get in the car. We had to get back to Ringgold, Georgia. And, I just told him off the whole way down there. I feel quite guilty sometimes I spoke to him because I was so frustrated. And we get to court, and I decide to tell the court this lame-sounding excuse that he had for being at the doctor and not being in court. And I said, Your Honor, he says he got bit by a giant spider, and I was kind of like trying to wink at the judge, like, you know, give us a break, Judge. Look what I'm working with here. Suddenly the judge just, his face went ashen, and I turned around and Alvin had raised his shirt, revealing the most grotesque big spider bite I've ever seen. So he was actually legit about that. And the judge said, oh, we'll do this another day. You know, you go home and rest. So it was just constantly that. And I had to try two murder cases back to back. But we're drawing out of the same jury pool. So I insisted that Alvin come and answer up the calendar and then sit and help me take notes of potential jurors, because we're going to be drawing his jury just in a few days out of the same group of people. Well, I didn't see, but Alvin escaped and was detained in Rome, Georgia, an hour away, for giving the U.S. Marshals the bum's rush and running into a federal judge's office reeking of gasoline they thought he had doused himself with, screaming about his lawyer not having knocked his case out yet, according to what they said. So Alvin explained to them that his car had broken down, that he had gotten up into the carburetor and got what he calls the perfumes of gas on him. And so I was waiting on him when he got home. I was so mad. It was after that day of the first trial I had to try. And I was telling him off, and I said, "What in the hell were you thinking?" And he said, "Well, my legal advisor suggested I try that." Well, I was the only guy I thought that talked to him. And so I said, "Who is your legal advisor?" He said, "Salesman Sam." Well, Salesman Sam was a guy who rode on a bicycle selling things out of catalogs in the basket of the bicycle. And when I confronted this guy for practicing law without a license, he suggested that he had been given Alvin Ridley legal advice since before I could walk. So I had to deal with that as well. And it was just an ordeal. And there at the trial, we did bring Dr. Wanamaker in, who testified beautifully. It set up the notion that the petechial hemorrhages that the state was depending on to show asphyxiation, a soft strangulation or suffocation with a pillow. Our theory was that Virginia had a seizure sleeping on her front and positioned herself to where either she could not breathe or the saliva formed a seal around her mouth and she was seizing and in a position not to even turn her head to get a breath. Or as Dr. Wanamaker said, sometimes they just die during seizure activity. And so what was so interesting was I had planned all along, no way is Alvin going to testify, because I knew if I was trying to make him a sympathetic character and he wanted to talk about the county taking his van, that was going to be a problem. And lo and behold, Jesus, during lunch, showed up and directed Alvin that he had to testify. And I was very skeptical, but that is the one thing that is the defendant's call. The lawyer can make all kinds of strategy decisions, what witness to call, what defenses to use. But as to whether or not you testify, that is the sole province of the defendant. And so I knew he was going to testify. I just tried to prepare him for it. As it turned out, he testified beautifully because I let Alvin be Alvin. We just decided to let all the conspiracies unspool, and including the eviction and including the various seizures. And there was just enough small town vindictiveness in some of these old stories that, you know, it's that old saying, just because you're paranoid don't mean they're not after you. And so there was just enough of that to make Alvin somewhat of a sympathetic figure. But I would forget how literal, and I would get ahead of myself, and I would say, "Alvin, tell the jury what you lost." And I was wanting him to say, "The love of my life," or "my best friend." And he looked and he says, "Oh, I guess the funeral bill." Well, you can imagine what the DA did with that. Of course, the DA had his own problems, because I figured if I couldn't get anything out of Alvin in 15 months, I wasn't worried about the DA getting anything out of him. And sure enough, the DA was struggling with him over the notion of where he got the quarter to make his phone calls that morning. He didn't realize that Alvin slept in his clothes, and he didn't realize that Alvin also slept with what sounded like $23 in coin in his pocket. So because he was rattling it throughout the whole trial, I was constantly grabbing his arm. Well, gentlemen, we won the case, but only 3 years ago. And by the way, this case has been featured on Forensic Files, American Justice, People Magazine, NPR's Snap Judgment, the Washington Post front page, but none of them could explain Alvin. He just was a Southern eccentric. And about 3 years ago, we were participating in another podcast, and I just gave the story away to anybody who wanted to listen. It was that Maya Angelou agony that I was, I just wanted the story to get out. But one of the jurors in the case, Kimberly Clark Barnes, she's now a nurse in Alaska. And she told the podcast maker, she asked him to ask me, did I ever consider the fact that Alvin may be autistic? She had worked with people on the spectrum, and she recognized some of the things. Well, it suddenly made me realize, made me feel very guilty for the conflicts that I would have with Alvin. But it also made me realize that his autistic mannerisms, and he is on the spectrum. An evaluation in Atlanta revealed that. But it also made me realize that the very autistic mannerisms that helped the doctor come to the conclusion that he is on the spectrum, they were being used against him at trial. His flat vocal effect when he called 911 about his dead wife, what the officers thought was a mismatch in the moment and Alvin's emotional response to the moment. And the grudges, good Lord, grudges from childhood we had to deal with. When picking a jury, Alvin's only standard was, if they like him, he likes them. That's all he said. I would try to be a little more strategic about that. But, we got a couple of people that knew him that he had worked on their television, like mine when I was a child. So the revelation of Alvin's autism finally formed the book in my head. I did some research and I learned that there are 5.5 million undiagnosed adults with autism that are walking around today. Now, I guarantee if they're having interaction with an inquisitor, like a police officer and a detective or a judge, they may very well rub them the wrong way. They may very well be so seemingly evasive with the answer to their questions. Really, it's a processing issue. Just as Alvin could not process the language that I used to ask him questions, we all speak in reference and metaphor and things that are shorthand for us. But a person on the spectrum very often can't process that language. And at the same time, I was having a process issue with Alvin and how he was reacting and how he was answering questions. That was making me have a processing issue for him. So, we've had autistic people since time began, and some of them are on the part of the spectrum that they can be so laser focused on things and be brilliant, be the greatest contributors to science and arts. And Alvin was a hell of a TV repairman. That was his proudest time, because he did everybody right. He was kind of cheaper than most, which is why my dad used him. He was very proud of what he did. He was an odd man. He didn't like to bathe. Another autistic trait, he didn't like the feel of water on his skin. And that made me feel really bad, because I kind of got on him about not going to the truck stop and getting a shower before trial. I felt bad the minute I said something to him about it. So something in me knew this man can't really help his condition. Interestingly, within 48 hours of me commenting on his smell, a skunk got in the register under my office and sprayed me and the files of the case, causing Alvin to complain how I smelled the next time we got together. He said, "Did you have a falling out with a skunk?" It made me realize I deserve that. We can't always help our circumstances,
How do you think this whole case, this whole process of going through this and writing it out in the book, all the details and getting it out there, how do you think that's changed you?
Immensely. First, my first fits and starts were just anecdotes. The story about the skunk, for example, the story about the finding Virginia's writings. There's a hilarious story about his two cats that I won't go into now. I got to save something for the readers. So it was just this disconnected recording of things while it was fresh on my mind. But I met I tried with four co-writers over the years. And, you know, they would fiddle around with it. And then they would say, you know, not really getting anywhere with this. And so the autism diagnosis formed it finally in my head that this is a cause that I am concerned about other people. But it was not until I really kind of dug under some scar tissue and hit some raw nerves going on in my own life and to be able to share what representing the Zenith Man, Alvin Ridley, what it did for me, that I think finally made it sing, as my publisher said, as a book. The changes that I was going through, my father, who I loved dearly, suffered with alcoholism all of my life. And I realized, looking back on notes, that we were hospitalizing my father about the time I was first starting to counsel Alvin. And once my father sobered up, I had a good talk with him, one of the first good talks I'd had with him in years. And he said he encouraged me to help Alvin. And he said he's a good man. He just he thinks differently than others. And that's all I had to go on. So I kind of, you know, wanting to please my dad, wanting to get revenge on the congressman. I had a lot of motivations for sticking with Alvin. And I learned slowly that Alvin was a good person. He had a bit of a charm about him, especially when there were any ladies around. He was raised right. So I made sure I had a secretary or my high school intern around, and Alvin was the absolute quietest, most polite person in the world when they were around. So we figured out how to keep from yelling at each other between the fake prayers and having one of the secretaries around. But I had to literally, because of his issues about Virginia's writings, I had to basically pay him to rent the writings to make copies. And while he's hovering over me, making sure that I put every one of them back, I would find one that I thought, if he doesn't bring this, we're going to lose. So I would say, Alvin, do you want a Coke? Go to the fridge in there in the office and grab one for you. And I would drop that one behind the copier because I wanted to be sure I had something, because he wouldn't let me keep it. So he brings these suitcases to court with all her writings that I had picked out. And then he would shuffle them around where I could not even find what I had picked out. But with the suitcases, he brought in scores of cockroaches into the courtroom. So badly that on Forensic Files, Season 5, Episode 9, juror Kimberly Clark Barnes comments on it on the air. And we released so many roaches into the courtroom that the judge, knowing that his office was right next to that one, ordered us to finish the trial in the old courthouse, in the old 1939 large grand courtroom, the last place Virginia Ridley had ever been seen in public, September 15, 1970. So it was eerie. I'm not a real ghost chaser or anything like that, but there was an eeriness to reuniting Virginia's writings with the last place she had ever been seen. And so between that and Alvin defying my advice and taking the stand, he was acquitted. And I feel very fortunate to have been a part of his case. For the last 25 years, for the most part of 25 years, Alvin and I have had lunch every week. And he turns 82 in a few days. He's still the same as he always was. But he's a lot calmer now, and I attributed that to the community warming up to him. He allowed me to be very public with his autism diagnosis. I think we know so much more about autism now, And a lot of people have someone with autism in their family. And so we've had some quite poignant meetings between Alvin and the people who were trying to put him in prison the rest of his life, who now are very kind to him. One of the main witnesses against him had him over for Thanksgiving dinner. And I mean Christmas. Had him over to their house on Christmas because he got lost and I had to leave my family to go make sure he got there. So it's just kind of a small town tale. By the way, Virginia was obsessed with the actor, director, producer, Ron Howard. And if you think about it, Ron Howard always played these very wholesome roles in either the Andy Griffith Show or Happy Days. She was obsessed with him. And I introduced a photo of Ron Howard and his new wife, Cheryl, that she wrote all over. And so I just wanted the jurors to see, look, this lady was into popular culture. It may have been kind of wholesome popular culture between the Waltons and Ron Howard, but she was living a happy life. She wrote that God told her to quit taking her medicine in September of 1977. Well, that meant she lived 20 years without medicating. And dutifully, because Alvin threw nothing away, we had the empty medicine bottles up until September of 1977, and we had several months of filled medicine bottles from that date and beyond. So Alvin was trying to take care of her.
Now, do you think that this case changed or might change in retrospect how the court system or lawyers work with people like Alvin?
Well, it's going to take the book to get the word out, because the book is the first telling of the story that includes his autism. And so hopefully there will be a rethinking. I've reached out to a lot of, there's a lot of groups that concentrate on autism and the criminal justice system. And I'm hoping that it does something to help. I know years ago that there was a general police training component about dealing with someone with a mental illness, like if it's obvious or if you're told that that person, for example, is schizophrenic. And it's a more measured, slow approach. Get as many other officers with you as possible and just slowly close in while you're talking the whole time to try to secure them. Well, with Alvin, it's not that detectable at first. And autism, again, has nothing to do with the intellect. Some of the smartest people in the world are on the spectrum. But it does have to do with the processing of orders and slang that's often used by, you know, all of us. And, you know, you throw slang language at somebody like Alvin, and he's going to wonder, what in the hell are you saying? You're making no sense. You know, it's just one of those things that I hope does gets people thinking, both law enforcement evaluators when a person has a psychological evaluation for forensic purposes, and judges. We all know judges who can have their day ruined by a client that they think, not a client, a person standing before them that they think is just being disrespectful to the court, and that can ruin somebody's day. Well, it could be that they're just having problems processing the court, or they're not showing the right emotion that the court thinks that they should be showing. So I've been very pleased that a lot of people who have an autistic person in their family, they've read my book, and they said, yes, I could have told you that he was on the spectrum by the way you're describing him. I'm just glad that Alvin has his best life right now. He has respect in the community. He has people kind of understand now why he doesn't like to bathe. I bought him a new suit. The guy's always had an air of dignity about him. His hair is always nicely done. Now he gets it mostly buzzed off, but he used to have hair that was always combed. He was always clean shaven. And so he had a dignity about him, And hopefully he gets to retain that now for the rest of his years.
Yeah, it's quite a world. Well, at least nowadays people are aware of autism and they're a little bit more on it. I know when I was young, nobody really considered it, right? It wasn't something that people talked about. So it's changed a lot. So I think it's going in the right direction. Just takes
time. I do too. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution opined about my book that we used to just be dismissive of people like Alvin, and we just called them the town eccentrics. And every small town had them. The only difference between small towns and big towns is that we all know ours by name. And we know we know their mama and daddy, maybe. And we know some of their backstory. That's the only difference in a small town. But it doesn't make it any easier when Alvin would be carrying on like he was with his litigiousness and with his kind of a odd causal relationships that he would apply to that litigiousness. So it was very, now hopefully we can see these individuals as people and as people who perhaps see things differently and hear things differently than the rest of us.
Well, okay, so let's see. Book is available. Do you have a website? Do you do social media for readers to find?
How do it all. I'm easy to find. There's not many McCracken Postons. And my son and I are the only living ones. I was the son of McCracken Poston Sr. And my son, one of my sons is at the University of Georgia. But he has a different middle name, so he's not a junior or a third. On Twitter, it's at Real Zenith Man. I say it at Real Zenith Man because there's another book out there called Zenith Man, and it's our story, fictionalized. Kind of made me mad at first, but it was also a great motivator to sit down and start writing. And so there's no copyright in titles. So, you know, New Line Cinema almost did a movie about this case 20 years ago. And it wouldn't have been that good because we didn't know the autism angle then. So that may have been why it never got made. But McCracken Poston Jr. for Junior you ought to be able to find me on Facebook, Instagram, even TikTok, which is totally baffling to me. But I've had a lot of children and teenagers explain to me what it is and what it does. So
they'll have a good time. It's all good. Okay. Now we're going to have your book up. We'll have everything for people to find you, and appreciate you being here. Great book. It's called The Zenith Man. It's Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. And the author is McCracken Poston Jr. Thank you again for being here.
It's the kissing couple on the cover, and that's Alvin and Virginia, a rare photo of Virginia.
Oh, that is her, eh? Oh, that's great.
From a photo booth at a local amusement park. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.